Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of Yes Sir, HR. As usual, my name is Mark, and I am with...
You're still with me, mate. Dennis here in a very wet and grey, cold Channel Islands in Jersey.
Okay, so let's jump straight into today's session. There was an article that I came across, and I know we talked about artificial intelligence for quite a few episodes, but I think this is worth exploring. Because it is from Stanford Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. Apparently, it's a center that focuses on looking at how human-centered artificial intelligence can actually improve education and teaching and learning. So what we're going to do today is really answer the central question and dissect a little bit about an article that Stanford wrote on how can AI and other applications be best used to advance human learning. Does that sound good?
Yeah, I mean, we have looked a little bit about on ChatGPT and how that can be used, but the old area of artificial intelligence and the old technology field is going to figure more and more with teaching and learning. And there's certainly going to be a revolution in terms of learning environments and the application of pedagogy, even though the pedagogic principles that we outline and go into in some detail, core principles of learning will remain generic.
Okay, cool. So I will put the link to the article for our listeners to access so that they can see and read the whole article in its entirety. But I thought we can start off by, actually, I just want to share a quote that was said by the Graduate School of Education, Dean Daniel Schwartz, who said, technology offers the prospect of universal access to increase fundamentally new ways of teaching. I want to emphasize that a lot of AI is also going to automate really bad ways of teaching. So we need to think about it as a way of creating new types of teaching. So before we jump into the points about how AI can support new ways of teaching, your thoughts on this quote?
Well, there's two aspects here. That if we're going to use technology, and this goes back, it's not just AI. I mean, when we talked about online learning for years, and it was going to be the best thing since sliced bread. I mean, it wasn't for probably decades because it wasn't pedagogically sound. So we can automate lots of things with AI, but if we're actually automating pedagogy that is not evidence-based, then it's not going to be good. It's like anything else. If you can play tennis for days and days and months, but if your technique's not right, the practice it's not going to be good. So it's kind of right that we can make this something that could create, when we say new ways of teaching, well, that's going to be an interesting one that we will explore. But it can certainly, if we're going to automate bad practices, all we're doing is institutionalizing bad practices, whether it's face-to-face with that technology or whether it's through very sophisticated technology. We know, don't we, that a lot of technology use is making very simple things very complicated. So just because it's technology-based and it all looks kind of nice and pretty doesn't necessarily make it good.
Yep. Okay. So I'm going to share a little bit about what the article talks about, how we can actually harness the potential of AI in teaching and learning, and also to maybe possibly get to these new models of teaching. I don't know what that means. It sounds, as you know, education speak. That's what I suppose administrators would say, as opposed to people who are actually teaching in the classroom. But nonetheless, let's try and explore this. So number one, what they have come up with is AI can actually help enhance personalized support for teachers at scale. But they have caveated this statement by saying great teachers remain at the cornerstone of effective learning, yet teachers receive limited actionable feedback to improve their practice. AI presents an opportunity to support teachers as they refine their craft at scale by, one, simulating students, two, providing real-time feedback and suggestions, three, post-teaching feedback, and four, refreshing expertise. So let's start off with the first one about simulating students. What do you think of that one?
Well, if you're going to turn around and say it can act as a simulation exercises, yeah, sure. I mean, you can ask the AI questions and see how it responds. And if you're getting good responses, then they may work in class. And given that these AIs are becoming more, if you like, interactive, you can ask it for advice. I want students to do better analysis in an history class. How might I use a model of thinking, or how might I ask analysis questions about a particular historical event? So certainly it can be a practice tool. I see that first one very much of developing, and the fourth point there, refreshing expertise, because what the AI can do, particularly the chatbots, is to find not just new information, but also ways of presenting that information. So yes, you can use it as a kind of simulation exercise to see how the AI responds. And if the AI is confused, then there's a fair chance that the students will be confused. If the AI can respond very positively, it's practice, but I see it more as providing a holistic set of resources, both at content level and at procedural knowledge delivery level. So yeah, it will. It can do that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The second one is provide real time feedback and suggestions. Okay. And one of the participants who contributed to this article says that AI has the ability to provide real time feedback and suggestions to teachers. Okay. Questions to ask the class, creating a bank of life advice based on expert pedagogy. You agree with that?
Well, it depends on, again, the AI is what is put into it. When we say expert pedagogy, yeah, if the AI has a very good current cognitive science-based pedagogy and is very much evidence-based, then it can. But if you're gonna load it up with pedagogy that is not evidence-based, then it's going to give you very good advice, expert advice, based on that model. So it all depends on how it's programmed, with what kind of algorithms and heuristics or whatever. So yes, it can do that. Yeah.
Okay. So I particularly like that one because I've used it quite a fair bit. I've even used ChatGPT as a critical friend to critique and give feedback on certain artifacts that I created for teaching. While not exactly superb, I think it does the job. And I hope that once it starts to mature a little bit more, we probably will get for it to give even more rich feedback. Although I did come across an article and I regret not snapping it or keeping the link, because it says, yes, it's true, ChatGPT is getting dumber. So I thought that was quite funny. I think I'll probably go and Google the article and see if I can find it. And maybe we will use it for our next pod. But anyway, moving on. Okay, so AI also providing post-teaching feedback. Okay, so how do you see that happening for teachers when we use AI to provide post-teaching feedback?
Well, it depends on how sophisticated the technology is. I mean,
let's say we're using ChatGPT.
Yeah, well, I mean, ChatGPT can link into many things, can't it, theoretically? If we are having a video session, so if we video a teaching session and that can somehow be captured by ChatGPT, and we ask it to analyze certain things like, did we get the response we wanted from our advanced organizer? Was the feedback clear? Was the questioning techniques appropriate for particular concepts? Yeah, that would be massive, wouldn't it? Again, it would still depend on the programming of the AI, wouldn't it? So yeah, it's, and also obviously you've got learning analytics, isn't it? If you're running a class and you're able to feed in student data in some way and ask it to do various things to aggregate data to come up with kind of generalities about what's going on in the classroom. Yeah, it can do that. So yeah, it certainly can do that.
Okay.
So I mean, these are all things that, and obviously as the things become more integrated, more sophisticated, that could get better. It still needs the teacher to have good pedagogic understanding and practice to know how to use this in situ with students.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think what we are saying is teachers themselves need to have a good basic understanding of pedagogy, literacy. So in order for them to be able to critically assess whatever is coming back is legitimate or not. So I think that's absolutely critical. And I don't think the AI has reached that level of sophistication where we can trust it 100%. I think the day that it does, we are all going to be terminated once we reach that level. So to add on to the last point about how AI can enhance personalized support is this comment by Sal Khan, who happened to be the founder of Khan Academy. Are you familiar with Khan Academy? I think you are, right?
I've heard of it, can't place it specifically now, but yeah, it's been around for a while.
Yeah. So he suggested that AI could help teachers stay up to date with the latest advancements in their field. For example, biology teacher would have AI update them on the latest breakthrough in cancer research or leverage AI to update their curriculum. What do you think of that one?
That's the big area. For example, I'm going to teach some history classes right now.
Yep.
When we talk about history, history is a massive subject. I did A-level history at school, and it was kind of, the Industrial Revolution in England, that kind of stuff, social and economic history. But you could also have done an A-level in kind of history of the Roman times and whatever. So, you know, history is such a massive subject. So no history teacher would be able to teach all aspects of history. You imagine the history of England, the history of Australia, the history of Africa, it's impossible. So what you can now do, if I've got to say teach something on just say slavery, just for example, or the Holocaust, I can go into ChatGTP and say, provide me a summary of the key features that led to the Holocaust in Germany prior to the Second World War. And it's going to come up with quite a lot of stuff. So I haven't got hunter round history books. I mean, you imagine you were teaching history, say 40, 50 years ago before technology, you would have to be extracting stuff from history books, putting it into note form, and then going in and dictating it in class. Now you can get ChatGPT to say, give me a summary first. So I've got the key concepts. Now let's take a particular thing. Like if you take Nazi Germany, there's different aspects of the things that led to perhaps Hitler becoming a successful in terms of achieving power. That there were things about the German economy, things about German parenting. If you read Wilhelm Reich's book on the mass psychology of fascism, he pulls together lots of things. So it's really good for lesson preparation. Again, you've got to be able to extract the key concepts, and then the information you've got given, you then got to make that an interesting contextualized activity in the classroom. But yeah, absolutely, it will be a godsend, I think, for teachers to keep up to date with the most current information. I mean, ChatGPT only goes to like 2021, so it's not current, is it? I mean, anything that's happened in the last couple of years is not going to be captured.
Right. Okay. So I think, yeah, that is one key factor that I think most teachers can leverage the potential of AI in that manner. And I think the second point that the experts in Stanford are making is changing what is important for learners. Okay. And they frame it by proposing this question. Is generative AI comparable to the calculator in the classroom, or will it be a more detrimental tool? Okay, so if you use the calculator as an example, it is now so ubiquitous in middle and high schools, it enables students to solve complex computations, graphications, and solve problems. Okay, however, it has not resulted in the removal of basic mathematical computation from the curriculum. Students still know how to do long division and calculate exponents without technological assistance. On the other hand, what Rob Wright is saying is, okay, writing is a way of learning how to think. Could outsourcing much of that work to AI harm students' critical thinking development. And I know we talked a little bit about this, but maybe what we can do is, first, I would like to hear your thoughts on what you think he's saying, and how can we prevent that from happening by linking it to evidence-based principles?
Okay, there's a couple of things there. There's the acquisition of declarative knowledge. You know, England won the World Cup in 1966. Jeff Hirst scored a hat-trick. The Germans scored first in the 12th minute by Helmut Aller. They equalised in the 89th minute by Karl-Heinz Schnellinger. Now, that's in my long-term memory system because I was there, right? Okay, so that kind of factual knowledge, I think, is purely getting it into your memory system. However, if you talk about writing an essay, for example, where you are pulling together concepts, you're applying critical thinking in historical analysis, for example, yes, you can look at exemplars, and we know you can get ChatGPT to write you an essay, a critical analysis of the main features that led to Hitler's rise to power. You can do that, and it could be very good. And if you can submit it and you don't get done for plagiarism, you might get a grade A, right? However, as that developed the skill in writing, and that's where I think the big issue comes in. It's if it's purely the acquisition of factual knowledge, then why are we bothering? Why would you want students to memorize the tide timetable for every port in the world as part of learning maritime history, when you know it's impossible to put all that stuff in your long-term memory, and you can just access that in a book or through AI. But to be able to make those kind of critical thinking situated decisions, you do need to have those neural networks in your brain that enable you to do that. And I don't think that comes just from extracting stuff from ChatGPT. It's like showing students model answers. Yeah, I mean, great. A student can say, and they're useful. We know that to get people to learn something, to get good at something, show them different levels of, if you like, expertise. You know, like the rubric, you know, what is a 5 rubric, you know, where it's that's the best score they can get, as compared to a 1 rubric, which means you've basically done it pretty badly. Okay, so we know that helps to model it in your mind, but simply by a student looking at a grade 5 essay doesn't mean, if they don't have the language skills and the thinking skills, they can replicate that. It's like me watching Roger Federer play tennis. I can see exactly what he does, but I can't do it. We've got to recognize that the information provided by ChatGPT and any of these AI tools is going to help understanding. Because if the student's using ChatGPT and doesn't understand something, and this is where I think the personalization and the personal tutor thing is going to be the big thing with ChatGPT, is that if I don't understand something, in other words, I'm reading something and the word ontology crops up. Well, from an ontological perspective, now I know, because it's my subject area, when we talk about ontology, we're talking about the nature of reality. But a student might see this word and immediately say, well, what does ontology mean? And can you give me some examples in relation to studying history? And then it will explain, well, it's to do with the nature of reality and the kind of assumptions we have about the nature of reality. For example, you know, if someone talked about metaphysics, something being metaphysical, it pertains to the idea of some kind of godlike figure or something that is not something that we know about in our everyday lives. So I see it as a great assistant. I mean, just like the calculator is great. But then again, the thing with the mathematics is that with a calculator, it's very, very convenient because it is a pure algorithm. 567 times 25 divided by 4. I couldn't do that in my head, right? But it's always one right answer, okay? It's a given algorithm, but a lot of student work is not an algorithm, is it? It's heuristic. You know, to write a good creative essay is not something that you can... I mean, you could copy one and submit it and plagiarize it, but that don't develop the skill of creative writing, I don't think. So it's a valuable resource, yeah.
Yeah. So then the counter argument to this is that maybe students don't need to require mastery of proficiency, because AI can fill in the blanks. Now, I have a problem with that. Do you?
Yeah, I do, because the thing is that it's a bit like sort of plumbing. Just to have an example, that I can go on the internet and I can see how to deal with a plumbing problem, but I wouldn't be able to do it in the real world. So, yeah, the danger is that we can have students learning stuff, getting so-called qualifications, but not actually having the competence to deal with real-world problem solving, particularly if it's not something that they've actually seen before. In other words, they don't have good transfer. And I think transfer only comes with application in context. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So I think what we are now seeing is students not only have to edit and curate and then forcing them to engage deeper in thinking, but really, I think what we need them to do is also have a good basic grounding of the knowledge. And we cannot expect AI to fill in the gaps for them. While it can help support, they still need to have some form of basic grounding in the subject area that they are studying. Would that be a fair comment?
Well, the grounding can come from the ChatGPT. For example, let's suppose I'm teaching, I'm just using an example, history, but it could be biology, it could be anything. You could say to students, look, use ChatGPT or whatever bot we've got at the time and look at, say, well, let's go out of history, let's go into biology. Let's suppose you're looking at, you know, cancer. Is look at what is the basic cause of cancer, what is cancer at the most basic level, and then apply that to cancer of the lung. So you could give students an assignment simply, which would be an essential question. If you take the work of Wiggins and McTighe, right? Okay, yep. Standing by design. I mean, one of their major contributions to pedagogy was, well, when you're teaching a subject, focus. I mean, a core principle of learning is teach core principles relating to the topic, right? So what if you go into the language of Wiggins and McTighe, you look at a topic and say, well, what is a big question, an essential question here? So if you look at, say, biology and you're looking at diseases, an essential question is, what are the causes of a disease? In other words, you know, what are the basic causes of cancer? Now, there might be many, many causes, right? And for different types of cancer, but you can start off, well, what are some of the main causes or the biological problems or forms? I mean, it's basically cell mitosis, I think, isn't it? It's kind of unnatural cell mitosis. So you can ask students something like that, and then you can then say, right, now you take one type of cancer and research it, find out and analyze, evaluate what you think are the most important causes. Then you can say, right, okay, well, if that's the causes, how might we prevent it, treatment, etc., the way we our lifestyle. So you can use it's giving students the right questions as assignments. I mean, who's it? Anthony Robbins says thinking is no more than the asking and answering of questions, right? So this is where I see it as a great resource, both for finding content and curing the thinking process. So if you give students essential questions, they can then go into the AI, come back into class and say, well, okay. And particularly if you're, you know, doing some cooperative learning or whatever, so students are having to engage with each other and do some peer instruction and peer assessment, it will take a lot of preparation time and legwork from teachers. So teachers who can teach from a good pedagogic standpoint and teach smart in terms of asking those essential questions, the big ideas, again, another term used by Wiggins and McTighe, then it's going to save an hell of a lot of preparation time. And if you then start using good pedagogic techniques, like we talked about, sort of things like peer instruction, get students to be assessing each other. And again, they can go into the ChatGPT or whatever it is and use that as an assessment tool. So you can get students to do a lot of independent work by the way you design your questions and ideas and the activities that you give them. And then you've just got to basically facilitate that in class. And that makes the teaching so much more interesting. Do you really want to show 20 PowerPoint slides and students looking at it and taking notes or just following it? It's really boring. So I think you can take that big chunk of content delivery out of the teaching process and, yes, access that content, but access it from the point of view of essential questions, big ideas, and real-world problem solving. But make sure that they do read it and do think about it and do understand it. And that's where the assessment process becomes more important, I think, in terms of teaching, because you've got to assess that students are understanding what they're doing and not just cutting and pasting stuff. But we did talk about the issue of assessment, that teachers can save a lot of time in preparation, but they will have to be more skillful in the way they facilitate the learning process and how to get students to do more of the assessment, and certainly most of the formative assessment at that level, and then you would moderate that.
Okay, cool. Now, the other thing that AI can do to transform teaching and learning is it can enable learning without fear of judgment. Okay, so AI has the potential to support learners' self-confidence. Teachers commonly encourage class participation by insisting that there is no such thing as a stupid question. However, for most students, fear of judgment from their peers holds them back from fully engaging in the concepts. So, interfaces that leverage AI can offer constructive feedback that does not carry the same stakes or cause the same consciousness as human responses. And the argument is, therefore, learners are therefore more willing to engage, take risks, and be vulnerable. Does that convince you?
Oh, absolutely. Look, think about it. Let's suppose you're taking part in a quiz, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And you've done quizzes. You know, you have quiz nights, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're in the team. Do you volunteer the answer when you're not sure about it? Like if I said to you, right, who scored for Ker Alexander against Stockport United in 1938 on a Tuesday evening? Would you be confident with that question? I wouldn't be.
Yeah.
I'm just making the example up. But the nice thing about the ChatGPT, and I think it's really important that we teach students how to use these tools alongside a model of thinking that they ask questions like that are based on analysis. You know, can you give me the causes of this? Compare and contrast. What inference and interpretations can be drawn by this person's view of the Holocaust or this person's view of cancer? So students have got to have a strong competence in what is critical thinking. But then once you get them to engage in the material, the student can sit at home and start saying, right, okay, have I learned, you know, the causes of cancer? And they can feed them into the machine and say, is this a complete or an accurate reflection of the research? And the machine can say, well, you're right on this, but you've missed this. And if the student gets it wrong, you don't get other members in the class saying, well, that's a stupid thing to say. So, yeah, it is a massive tool for students to practice. Look, let's, for example, think, you know, when you first did a paper at an international conference, did you not perhaps at home walk around the kitchen practicing it?
Yeah.
So you were pretty sure what you were doing. Now, I'm okay now if I'm at a conference anywhere in the world and you say to me, talk about creative teaching or evidence-based teaching or pretty much anything to do with pedagogy, because I've done so much of it. It's so ingrained in my long-term memory system that it just comes out. You ask me a question about, you know, what was John Attie's major effect sizes. I don't have to prepare that because it's there. So until you get that competence, then practice without fear of failure and expectation failure. So if you fail, who cares? I mean, ChatGP isn't going to say, you know, you're really stupid and I'm going to tell your teacher and you're going to fail. It will help you, won't it? So massive, massive point, I think, that is it. It gives learners the opportunity to experience expectation failure and plenty of deliberate practice and rehearsal practice, deliberate practice for skills. Yeah, that's a real big plus.
Okay. So the other one is improving learning and assessment quality. So if I can give you an example. Teachers know that learning happens through powerful classroom discussions. However, only one student can speak up at a time. So AI now has the potential to become like a teaching assistant to support a single teacher who's trying to generate 35 unique conversations with each student. Can you see that happening?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of, it depends on the technology tools and how familiar you are in integrating lots of responses. I mean, it's kind of data-enabled learning in the classroom, isn't it? If you can process and synthesize, you know, like when, you know, like the Kahoot, you know, the ability to have a quiz with the old class where everybody's participating individually and they get an immediate kind of feedback. So it's an extension of that. Anything that I think enables students to be able to experience the right level of differentiation and the right level of personalized feedback. So if I'm doing a Kahoot quiz and I get certain questions wrong, I'm getting immediate feedback on that. And if it then gives me the answer and an explanation of what makes it a correct answer, yeah, I mean, that's brilliant. I mean, that's the perfect learning tool, isn't it? It's like, what would be your ideal teacher? The teacher that could answer your questions in ways that you understand with examples that you could connect to and then build it up from there. And that's why people pay a lot of money for private tutors and particularly those that are very good in the field, because the most effective teaching method or the teaching thing is to have your own one-to-one tutor. I mean, that's just, you know, that is perfect differentiation for you, or customization for you. Unfortunately, only people who can afford the best tutors can do that. For example, if you look at a lot of people who are good at certain sports, it's because their parents were good at it, had plenty of money and could have the best coaches. I mean, Jack Nicholson's son played professional golf, lots of professional golfers, children, providing they're interested in it, can get pretty good at it because they're going to have access to best personalized coaching. And that's the ideal situation. It's like medicine, isn't it? You know, do you really want to sit in a waiting room for hours knowing you've got 10 minutes with a doctor who's maybe working 16 hours? What you want to do is to go immediately to the best expert in that area and have him all day looking at you because you're paying him £10,000 a day. Personalized medicine. And that's why, if you take the British royal family, I mean, the Queen Mother lived over 100. Elizabeth, I can't remember, but pretty much 100. These people tend to have really good personal care. So they're more likely to live longer. And that's a fact of life, isn't it? That, yep. You know, more you've got individual... Look, David Beckham travels around in an helicopter. Well, he doesn't get caught up in traffic jams, does he? If you follow up. So it's the same kind of thing. What what AI can do is it can create more, if you like, equity in the learning process, because as long as a student has access to that technology, obviously they're going to have the motivation and other factors, but all of a sudden they can access stuff that in the past or a facility that perhaps only wealthy people who could afford the best private tutors had. So, you know, in terms of cultural diversity, there's another point there, and also differentiation and equity issues. There is more of a democratization, if you like, to some extent, of access.
Okay. So while that is some of the ways in which we can harness the power of AI, and by the way, again, I just want to remind everybody listening, this is from Stanford. There are also some issues that they have brought up that might be an issue because AI is still in its infancy, especially for education. And one of it is these models, generative AI, do not optimize for student learning. And the example given is while ChatGPT spits out answers to queries, these responses are not designed to optimize for student learning. And as noted, the models are trained to deliver answers as fast as possible, but that is often in conflict with what would be pedagogically sound, whether that's a more in-depth explanation of key concepts or framing what is more likely to spark curiosity to learn more. Now, in your explorations with ChatGPT, do you find this to be a problem?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I asked it to plan me a bass fishing program, you know, in Cambodia, because what if I'm in Cambodia next year, I might do a bit of fishing, and it came up with some useful things, but like I didn't feel that confident that I had a good frame. I need to ask it more questions and it may or may not help. Look, the what we know, don't we, that with ChatGP 3.5, that when it was asked to do the entry exams for the American bar, about 10% passed with it, but with ChatGPT 90%. So we've got to work on the assumption that as these systems become more accurate, and certainly if you ask for referencing, it's not very good. So yeah, but it's like asking teachers, isn't it? I mean, how many teachers can be that current? I mean, I was listening to a podcast, funny enough, yesterday, where Richard Dawkins was interviewing somebody who was talking about, who'd written a book on gender issues. And Richard Dawkins' position is that there's basically two sexes, male and female, right? But yep. There are people who are arguing that you can just, that's not an objective fact. It's a guess that you can say, well, you know, I might have certain physical parts, but, you know, I see myself as this or that or whatever. And that's one of the big issues. And the question is, if you've got teachers, you've got some teachers saying that there's males and females and it's based on biology. And then you've got other teachers who are saying, well, not really, it's a choice. So. For the other gender or even something else, and we can start inventing different types of genders, and that's going on. I mean, I remember I think I've got to be careful what I say, but someone saying there may be up to 100 different genders. Well, you know, where do you go with this? Where you know, what is reality and what is perceptions of reality? And what we know is that there are many different perceptions of reality, okay? For example, if you take psychotherapy, which is something I've done a lot of, from my perspective, there are therapies that I think are not very useful at all, and I don't think are very evidence-based at all, or even useful. In fact, potentially dangerous. I'm not going to name what they are. I don't want to get caught up in that one, in this kind of thing. But it's like religions, isn't it? I mean, you know, you've got different religions now. They can't all be right, can they? I mean, they might all share an assumption that there is a metaphysical realm and being, and however you label that, but they can't all be right. So maybe they're all wrong. We just don't know. But there are billions of people who believe it's an objective reality or an act of faith. So this is the problem, isn't it, with knowledge that we put into these systems is how much is going to still be subjective. And the problem is students going in and thinking, oh, this is now online, it's fact. And that's one of the big problems with the internet. There's so much rubbish on it, but people go on there and think, oh, well, it's on the internet and therefore it must be right. Just like people reading newspapers. Well, you know, read different newspapers' accounts of different things and what's the reality? So getting a better frame on reality has got to be a main, in my opinion, educational objective. And that's why the thinking skills and the digital literacy and good thinking have got to come into play. And that's a big role that teachers play. But the problem is if teachers have got their own kind of subjective views that they, whether consciously or otherwise, are trying to get students to believe in certain things, then, it's still a bit of a mess. And all that ChatGPT could do is just add to the complexity. But if it's done well, it can actually be very positive and make the complex more simple, but not simplistic. So it can go either way. Look, it's like having a gun, isn't it? Like if somebody is going to kill my family and I've got a gun and I can stop them doing it by threatening to shoot them, or one could argue even shoot them, then maybe that's an okay use of a gun. I mean, we use it in wars, don't we? When governments tell us to go and, you know, do that kind of stuff. But equally, some unstable, dangerous, whatever you want to call them, person goes out and just fancies shooting a few people randomly. It's not a terribly good use of a gun, is it? So I think kind of we have to look at technology in terms of it's always a double-edged sword, and that will apply to AI and how it's used. Like, is it going to be used for weapons? Now, that's a bit of a worry. What happens if it gets in the hands of terrorist groups? That's a bit of a worry. If it's used well for authentic learning, I think that's a good thing if it's used to diagnose medical problems and solve problems of cancer treatments. It's a massive continuum between it being very good and very bad. And I think in different dimensions, it will oscillate in different ways. What we'd like is to pull it towards more positive ends and keep working in those areas. There's got to be some kind of ethical base to it.
Okay. So the other problem is I just wanted to just highlight this, which I thought was quite interesting. I wouldn't use the word funny, but it was interesting. And this was one by assistant professor of computer science, Chris Peach, who told a story about a student who recently came into his office crying. The student was concerned about the rapid progress of ChatGPT and how this would deter future job prospects after many years of learning how to code. Peach connected the student to a broader existential motivational crisis where many students may no longer know what they should be focusing on or don't see the value of their hard-earned skills. What do you think of that one?
Oh, well, we are really hitting. We're going out of, if you like, pedagogic fidelity to social issues. I mean, look, there are people that are suggesting that a lot of jobs are going to be automated. We know that. I mean, we can see it around us. Once we've got driverless cars and once we've got scans that can diagnose diseases better than a radiographer, and accountancy, you know, let's be honest about it, the days of clerks filling in ledgers, writing things in. So there are so many work functions that will get automated. So there's going to be job losses, redundancies. How we manage that as a social entity is a big issue. Now, in terms of students looking at life today, because it is a volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous world, and the threats to existential threats like global warming, not that I see any evidence of global warming where I live, but like it seems to be there, the threat of nuclear war, the threat of even alien invasion. I mean, you can go on and on and on of things to worry about. In fact, somebody wrote a book, I forget who it was, 129 things that we can worry about. Now, you know, we're all going to die, we're all going to suffer. So, you know, do we want to be permanently thinking, oh, well, when I get cancer and I'm going to be suffering and I'm in an old people's home and I can't pay the fees? So we have to, I think, develop with our students and ourselves ways of managing fear, anxiety, and so we have to live with these kind of worries, and all we can do is try to improve ourselves, and hopefully we will develop skills and knowledge and resilience that we'll be able to find meaning in life. I mean, it's as philosophical as that.
Okay, so I think that's just really scratching the edge of the surface of AI, and I'm pretty sure we will revisit this again once AI starts to evolve a little bit more. So let's move on to part two, which is something that we may have read, something that we may have come across, or something that we may have want to share in terms of an AI tool that we came across. So you want to go first then?
Yeah, I mean, it's not one tool as such. I mean, I watch a lot of the YouTube videos around artificial intelligence and things like this. And I'm still in the situation of trying to say, well, what kind of things might sway the balance more one way positively, or could lead it to become negative? And I do think a lot will depend on the society we live in, the kind of policy, the kind of politicians that we have, because that's going to be macro, isn't it? Like, if we're going to have schools that are open and say, right, we are going to have critical thinking as a major thing, and we are going to use technology to try to find the best evidence-based frame on all these world issues. And also, I think we're going to have more of an ethical consideration of society. It's all right saying, well, we're going to lose 70% of jobs to AI. Well, can we have 60% of the population unemployed? What kind of problems is that going to create? And it can create massive different scenarios. It could well be that, you know, it could be the Hunger Games in the worst situation, couldn't it? Or it could well be that we have a different distribution of wealth and we find different meanings in different kind of activities. I'm very much sort of doing my own fact finding on, you know, every week. If I look at YouTube, there's somebody with a different spin or someone's coming up with this. So I'm just in the process at the moment. I'm not changing week by week. I'm just trying to look at the systemic situation and potential systemic problems or systemic good solutions. I mean, I would like us to be able to reverse the aging process. And there are people talking about combinations of AI and diets and various things that we can do that, because I'd certainly like to I'd like to put my body back 40 years and have little bots floating around, feeding back anything that's going wrong and being able to have an artificial intelligence thing floating around in my body or coming along and zapping me with something and making me feel better. In fact, you know, I'm very interested in that side of artificial intelligence. So it isn't just about can it help students to learn better in schools and teachers to be able to be more effective and certainly more efficient. But it's the bigger picture of human life, human existence and where we go as a species, if you like. So much in that kind of sphere. I think I know a fair bit of what we can do with these technology tools that's positive for learning. And they've come out, I think, in our discussions. We also know what some of the dangers and limitations are. I mean, if the AI isn't terribly accurate, then that's going to kind of, it's a bit like a teacher not knowing the subject well, isn't it? But I do think probably a good AI system will probably know more than most teachers. And that should be the case, shouldn't it? Because that's, you know, that's what it will do. It will provide us with the most current, hopefully, evidence-based, fairly balanced view of a particular reality, whether that's to do with learning or the treatment of cancer or what we eat. I mean, more videos I look at on dieting and food intake. I mean, it's hard to see the wood from the trees. It's only because it's an area that I've studied well that I've got a decent picture. But some people will say, oh, red meat's really bad, don't eat it. And then you've got Jordan Peterson, who just lives on beef. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy who said he's cured all his, you know, arthritis, and his daughter, you know, had so many things, and she's just lived on beef, I think for 10 years or something like that, and seems to have said, well, she's so much healthier. And then other people say, no, it causes cancer. So we really have a reality issue, I think, both in terms of teaching and learning. What we try to do is focus on that reality of teaching and learning and say, look, these tools can do this if teachers can do that. And we also teach students these kind of cognitive skills to make the whole thing better. So it's a very holistic thing. So that's where I am at the moment. There isn't anything that is I've seen this week. It's just that I'm kind of trying to synthesize all the different perspectives and hopefully keep reasonably informed and can speak intelligently on this podcast about it. And that's what we try to do. We try to be current and we try to be authentic and honest. I think that's all we can do.
Okay. So thanks for sharing that one. I just have one. I'm not sure if I shared it before, but I'll say it again. I came across this link. It's called the AI Tool Report, and it says learn AI in 5 minutes a day. And essentially, it is a report that curates all the top AI tools. And it's a newsletter that gets delivered into your inbox. So that may be something you might be interested in.
Yeah, that would be good, because I'm just using YouTube, because it just seems to be such a massive depository of people who are experts in different fields and obviously people that have got an agenda. And, you know, I'm kind of careful in terms of looking at what, you know, what the sources of those informations are, because I can do that. So I'm more looking at that. But anything that I think that helps us to reduce the cognitive load on artificial intelligence, more we're able to make better decisions about things. So yeah, that's a good that. Well, I'll have a look at that this week, and then further down the line I'll give you my frame on that.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, I'll put the link for people who are interested to sign up. Yeah, so that really concludes another episode of our podcast. Once again, if you would like to write to us, you can do so at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. If not, we would appreciate it if you could share this link to other people who you think would probably enjoy listening to us talk a little bit about education. So that's it then. So we'll see you in the next episode. Take care, everyone, and goodbye.
Yeah, and goodbye from me.